Today at Reader's Corner, Jonathan Evason, author of the novel Lawn Boy. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Our guest today is best-selling novelist Jonathan Evason, a writer whose work frequently appears on the New York Times bestseller list. In his latest novel, Evason tells the story of Mike Munoz, a young Chicano living in Washington with a meager education in his rearview mirror and a lifetime of menial labor ahead of him. But Mike wants more. A powerful story about cultural rifts and class distinctions, Lawn Boy is a vibrant coming-of-age novel about the pursuit of the American dream. Jonathan Evason is the author of four novels, including All About Lulu, West of Here, and This Is Your Life, Harriet Chance. He last appeared on Reader's Corner in 2015 to talk about his best-selling novel, The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving. He will be appearing as part of the Story Fort lineup here in Boise, March 20 to 24. He joins us today by Skype from his home in Washington State. Jonathan Evason, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me, Bob. Good to be back.
I tell you, it's really a great little yarn you've told here that is, what shall we say, semi-autobiographical. Tell us about your Lawn Boy experiences and how that might have led to this book.
Well, you know, I grew up here on Bainbridge Island, which is a relatively affluent community, but we didn't have any money. I was raised by a single mom of five. My dad sort of dumped us off up here from the Bay Area and then left. And so class and class consciousness is something that was just kind of something I grew up with. You know, a lot of kids I went to school with had money, and we didn't have money. And my mom worked two jobs, and I pretty much was raised in the library. And, you know, you get a ride from your friends, you have them drop off at the end of the driveway because you don't want them to see your house. And so, you know, I've been carrying this idea of class around with me for a long time, and I always thought, you know, someday I'm going to write this big class novel, and I always thought I'd take more of the tack like I did with West of Here, with the, you know, where I took the tropes of history and sort of turned them in on their ear and subverted them, and I thought I would write a class novel like that. It would be, you know, maybe multi-generational with all these characters across time and space, and thought it'd be a real doorstop. But then I just found Mike's voice. I was between novels, and I had actually thrown a novel away that I was under contract for, and I was afraid to tell my publisher about it because, you know, I'd already gotten paid for the book. And so I just needed to write to write, and the commerce and the art were not a very comfortable dance at that point. So I just started this anonymous blog called Mike Munoz Saves the World, where it's just about a 23-year-old kid living with his mom on the res, working as a landscaper. And so I just started this blog, and Mike would just sort of wax about landscaping and kind of sort of grind his axes with wealth disparity and whatnot. And after about 30 or 40,000 words, I realized, man, this needs to be a novel. You know, this voice is all I need, is this young, irreverent voice to really use as my lens to look at class in America. And so kind of wrote itself at that point. I mean, I've been thinking about this stuff forever. You know, like all my books, it's character driven. And it's just, you know, I'm lucky enough to have lived my dream, you know, so I didn't want to forsake Mike. I wanted to give him a chance. His dream maybe is a little humbler than mine, but I don't know.
Well, you certainly lived this stuff, as you say, because as I said, I gather you were a lawn boy. You had somewhere along the line, I saw a list of what you've done in your younger years, and you've tried everything. Mike Munoz is not only a lawn boy, but he's a topiary specialist. Did you go that far?
To be honest, I wasn't really a lawn boy so much in my youth as I was when in my mid-30s before I had any novels published. It was kind of it was the last job I had before my life took that turn. Right before that, I'd been a caregiver. So I was like 36, 37 years old working in these rich people's yards. And one thing I noticed about it is that no matter how good I was at my job, and I became very skilled, I took classes, you know, I took classes on how to prune roses, and I took topiary classes, and I mean, my edges were gold. I was really good out there, but the wealthy people, they just treat you like a laborer. They don't, you know, nobody never knows your name, and you'd be working in their yard, doing their garden, and pretty soon they're asking you to go, you know, move their garbage cans out to the curb or clean out their garage or, you know, wash their car. So that really resonated with me. I was kind of an angry revolutionary gardener.
Well, as far as Mike Munoz is concerned, you mentioned briefly that, like you, his dad left the household. And there's a very sensitive moment early in your book where where you're talking about Mike's dad, and Mike Munoz just wants to go to Disneyland. That's his life dream. And tell us what happens. Not at the end, of course, but at the beginning.
Oh, yeah, yeah. God, I've written three books since then. So I'm trying, oh, yeah, so it's like the first scene of the book where, yeah, his dad, he's finally sick of him, just whining about going to Disneyland and talking about it. And so he puts him in the El Camino. He said, come on. And he's like, well, where are we going? He goes, going to Disneyland. So he gets in the car, and he starts driving him. He drives him off the island, off the res, through Paulsbo, into East Bremerton, to where they usually go to pick up their food stamps or get flu shots and stuff. And he takes them to the abandoned naval shipyard. And they sit there with their – it's raining out, and they get their hands clasped in the chain link fence. And Mike's like, well – he goes, looks like they move. Come on, let's go. Drives him back to the res.
It's funny in one way, but it's really sad in another, and it sets up your book, in a sense, for a guy who's really got a lot of baggage on his back as he's trying to find his way through life, right?
Yeah, I don't think people realize how hard it is. I don't think people realize the sort of day-to-day struggles about poverty. So I grew up in poverty, so I'm used to it. But people don't understand the decisions that people that don't have money, they make. Like smoking, for instance. You know, most poor people are clinically depressed, man. They're working two jobs. Cigarettes cost $6 a day, man, but they're a bargain for people. They get them through the day, man. They're a stimulant. So like the decision to smoke, which looks really dumb from a financial standpoint, is like a lifeline for some people. Or, you know, people wonder why poor people eat out at McDonald's and stuff like that. Well, if you live in an apartment that's got a pest problem and you don't want to be cooking because you're just drawing pests, I mean, it's hard to eat at home cheaper than it is at McDonald's and things like that. I mean, I just think, and it's just getting worse, the divide in this country, this sort of urban-rural divide where people just don't treat poor rural people as if they're human beings almost. I mean, this all this like white trash joking and like, I don't know. It's pretty grim.
Well, you clearly have made the point more than once, I believe, that in a sense your book is about working class distinctions and about how you're trying to help people better understand folks who come from the other side of the tracks or live on the other side of the tracks.
Yeah, it's like when Mike's on the lawn eating with those kind of the millennial kids that work at the charcuterie or something like that. But they're all kids that came from good homes with money and stuff. And Mike's explaining his situation. And he's like, well, yeah, my truck broke down. And they're like, well, why don't you just get a new truck? I mean, it doesn't even register with people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't, they don't even understand. They think Mike's problems are all self-created. Capitalism takes capital. Mm-hmm. It's the bottom line.
And
if you don't have anything to start with, you're not going to mobilize far in this culture.
And as far as your work is concerned, I mean, the simple fact of the matter is, as far as I can tell from reading your works, is that I couldn't write a novel like yours. I mean, not just because I'm not a good writer, but more importantly because I haven't been through what you've been through and experienced what you've experienced. And I believe at one point along the way you've actually contrasted your life experience in writing to the MFA program, the Master in Fine Arts in Writing, where students gather together to do, well, you tell us, what do they do, Jonathan?
Well, I read Dennis Johnson and learn how to distress their sentences, I guess. I just kind of took the mid-20th century model, I guess. I mean, it's, you know, you go back to the 1920s and 1930s and writers, the plan was go out and accrue some experience, you know? I mean, you go all the way back to Melville and Conrad. These guys went out to sea for years at a time. And Jack London went up to the Klondike and dug gold as well as going out to sea. And, like, even Hemingway, who was a Trustafarian, basically, had the good sense to go, you know, drive an ambulance in somebody else's war just to accrue that experience. It's so much about the experience. And what I feel about experience is I actually try to write outside of my experience, but I use my experience. So it's like write what I don't know, but, you know, use what I know. And that usually ends up being like all the jobs. That's why I can write like an insider about a job, because I've worked all these menial jobs. But, you know, emotionally or spiritually or however else, I'm trying to get outside myself. I'm trying to make myself a more expansive person by writing. And so every other novel or so, I write kind of more of a personal sort of talk to you like a friend character study, and then every other novel I usually go a little bit bigger, like at West of Here, where it's like hardly anything in that book's within my experience. You know, I'm not a 9-year-old autistic Indian kid. I'm not a new woman of the 1890s. I'm not an intrepid explorer of unexplored mountains. And but now I don't like to beat down on the MFA. It makes sense, but I just feel like it's done something to fiction. Like, I just feel like they've made it such a specialty, you know, like populist fiction is dead or something. Like, you get a liberal arts education and then they indoctrinate you with amazing stuff. I mean, you know, you'd be reading Tim O'Brien and Dennis Johnson and all these great writers. And then I read these novels and I'm like, okay, well, tell me a story. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, you're writing a lot of pretty sentences, but tell me a story. Move your character around. Well, you know, I want to own that, you know, like as a reader, I want to own the narrative and, you know, I want some story. So all my writing is in service to the story. Yeah. I'll write a lyrical sentence now and then when the story calls for it, but, I'm not going to fill a book with them.
Well, along the lines of your novels being in service to the story, you didn't really leave the revised fundamentals of caregiving completely behind in this novel, because Mike Munoz, who's trying to find his way in life and get a job and turn it into a career and be successful and make some money, ka-ching, ka-ching, as you say in your novel, he's got a brother. Tell us about his brother and where that guy comes from.
He's Mike's older brother, Nate. He's got a special needs older brother. And so as a caregiver, I mean, he's basically surrendered his birthright, because Nate, though he's the older brother, is the one that needs the care, and Mike takes care of him. There's like a caregiving element in almost all my books, really. I mean, Craig sort of cares for Rita. Harriet cares for Bernard when he's dealing with his dementia. And in this case, you know, Mike and his family deal with Nate. And that's just something I observed. I don't know that it's more common with working class people, but it just seems like there's so many more working class families that are dealing with problems like this. Maybe it's that they don't have specialists and caregivers. You know what I mean?
Right. You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Jonathan Evason, author of the new novel Lawn Boy. So you dropped a few names in this book that I found interesting: Upton Sinclair, W. Somerset Maugham, and Frank Norris. Now, I think I'm safe in saying that Frank Norris is not the household name that Upton Sinclair might be to folks who keep track of novels and nonfiction and what various things these guys wrote. Tell us a little bit about why you threw in Frank Norris.
Well, like, Norris is Steinbeck before Steinbeck. I think Californians know who Norris is more than anybody. He's kind of, in a way, I guess he's sort of a regional writer, but he wrote about the railroad. He wrote probably the last great novel of the 19th century, McTeague.
Right.
I got to write an intro for an edition of that book, which was a thrill because it's one of my favorite books. But, you know, Norris comes from the line of Dickens. He's a writer with a social conscience, you know? I mean, like when Mike's reading, I don't remember, I think he's reading The Octopus in Lawn Boy, and he's like, it could have been written yesterday. It's the same old story. The robber barons consolidating their wealth, and, you know, nobody else got nothing.
Well, as I said to you before we went on the air, I've enjoyed your books to the extent that you've centered them around Bainbridge Island, where I like to spend some time over the summers. Tell us whether or not a writer ever has to be careful or runs into any issues when describing real life places in your novels, or maybe it's just people coming back to you and saying, hey, thanks, or hey, you got a lot of nerve describing this that way or whatever. What's your thoughts on that?
There is always a risk of blowback. I have a t-shirt I wear to barbecues that says, careful, you'll wind up in my novel. You know, there is always the risk of social and political blowback. Like Mike's scene at the country club party. I actually went, I mean, that party, that really happened.
Did it really?
I went to that country club party, and all night long, everyone's going, oh, well, so-and-so, my nephew, wrote some poetry. But he was never published. I mean, just all night long, I was just, by the end of the night, I'm like, this poor guy. All he was trying to do is write some verse. So it's just a risk you got to take as a fiction writer. The interesting part about it is I have really not had too many people complain to me. I think that, oddly enough, people don't recognize themselves. Like, I love Bainbridge Island. You know, I grew up here. They've been super supportive of me. But I don't think, like, the people that I'm sort of railing on the upper middle class set of people I'm sort of railing on in this novel, I don't think they even recognize themselves because they show up in droves. You know, there's like 400 people at my launch event, you know, and nobody complained to me. Everybody just said they loved it. So, and I remember like my first book, my older brother was, he was convinced he was one of the twins, Ross, just because Ross is his middle name, and he couldn't even see that really, you know, him and his relationship with his father and stuff. That was based on, you know, Will was based on him. The protagonist was more based on him, but he just thought, oh, well, Ross, that's my middle name. That must be me. People just don't recognize themselves. It's odd. I always expect to get more blowback. I mean, there's lines I won't cross. You know what I mean? It is fiction, so you've always got that little bubble of protection. But, like, I think Harriet was pretty difficult for my mom, you know, because my mom is exactly Harriet's age. And there were certain experiences in Harriet's narrative that I think paralleled my mom's, not as many as somebody might think, but I think that book was really uncomfortable for her for that reason. I mean, of all my books, it's the one she kind of brings up the least, and yet it would be the most apropos for her if I were to recommend her book, you know? I think there's nothing you could do about it. I mean, if you're going to write, you're going to tell the truth. I don't ever throw anybody under the bus or anything like that. I haven't made any enemies so far, but I think that's mostly just the good fortune of people not even really recognizing themselves.
I think at one point you mentioned in one of your interviews that fortunately for you, your mom tended to find the little things in the book that really didn't make any difference to you, and that was always
exactly.
A good thing.
Yeah, right. She, you know, I mean, here's this person that's sort of based on her at times, and then she'd be like, oh, well, you know, he wasn't a Presbyterian, he was Methodist, you know, just that little stuff like that would drive her crazy. So I got that going for me, too.
Right, right. So Mike Munoz, at least two or three times in the novel, is called out for being Mexican. And at least at one point, he says, no, excuse me, I'm Californian. Help us with that.
I mean, you know, before 1846, it's the same thing.
Right.
It was all Mexico.
Yeah.
But, he's actually fifth generation Californian like me. He just happens to have Hispanic last name.
Right.
So I don't think he identifies, you know, he identifies as white, which is, allow me to, you know, also skirt, so, like, speaking of, like, issues, like, appropriation was a big conversation when this book first came out, and I'm not a proponent. I mean, I think, if we can't write outside our experience, what are we doing here? I mean,
right.
I can't ever write a woman. I can't even write a historical character because then I'm appropriating history. I mean, the whole idea for me is to get outside my own, you know, purvey of experience. And but with Mike, like, my nephews are half Hispanic, half white, and so I saw how they grew up, and I saw the stigma attached to that. Neither of them speak much Spanish. And so I did have a window into it. I wasn't just like making this stuff up, you know, so I did have an intimate view of it, but like, I think it allowed me to, you know, personally to sort of inhabit the book a little more closely.
Help our listeners understand in case there's somebody out there that might not catch that word appropriation and what that controversy or that issue means in writing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we live in a kind of a touchy time that way. So we're, you know, there was the lady that got shut down in Portland because she was making burritos at a stand. I thought she was a white lady, and so she, you know, people were up in arms that a white lady was making burritos. And I'm like, hey, listen, if it's a good burrito, it's a good burrito. I mean, if we don't have little appropriation, we don't have the Rolling Stones, we don't have, I mean, you know. I was actually hoping I would get caught up in some sort of dialogue about it, because I do think it's an important conversation. But, I mean, but from the very beginning, fiction is about writing outside of your experience, and so I don't think it's really applicable. Another thing that I've noticed about this book is, like, I mean, even in the New York Times, they call Mike Munoz a Holden Caulfield for a new millennium, which is, you know, I mean, as a writer, you're like, oh, great. You know, they just compared my protagonist to the Holden Caulfield. When you really think about it, it's just, like, completely untrue.
Right.
I mean, he's the antithesis of Holden Caulfield in a way. I mean, I know what they mean. He's like, talks to you like a friend. He's young. He's irreverent. But, I mean, if you strip away Holden's wealth and his entitlement and his safety net, I mean, what do you have? I mean, that's his whole character. Mike is like Holden with real problems, I guess.
One of the characters in your book really reminded of me of how successful you were in characterizing people who are living on the margin or people we don't know very well because they're different than us, how basically good they are. I want you to talk about Freddie. First of all, you know, I have to say as a reader, you introduced me to Freddie and I'm thinking, oh, brother, you know, a guy moves in on this guy's dad after the dad takes off, and where's this going? So tell us.
Sitting around on the couch, smoking joints, drinking grape soda with like one of his nuts hanging out. I love these characters because the world is full of these people that they look like a clown on the surface maybe, but they're really noble people. I mean, there's a lot of noble working class people. That's one of the things that I don't like about the era we're living in right now is that working class people have just become so marginalized. I mean, you know, like you said, you're almost kind of surprised that, oh, God, this guy's really nice. There's a lot of really good, kind people out there. And I don't know. I like writing characters that are kind of hard to redeem, too. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It seemed like, oh, God. You know, like Janet Maslin in the New York Times, I think it was for Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving, she said, I have a way with losers, which, you know, she meant as a compliment. But I'm like, see, this is what I'm talking about.
They're
not
losers.
Why are they losers? why is this character a loser? Because he's down on his luck. He's made a few bad decisions. Who hasn't done that? They've caught up with him. He was never in a great position in the first place. But we as a culture, we frame these people as losers. And it's interesting to me because nobody really seems to be writing that many books about him, man. Like for every book like Lawn Boy out there, I mean, there's like three books that are, you know, the whole conceit of the thing is like the wedding arrangements at a wedding in Cape Cod and like the drama. And it's like, this is why I love Dickens in the first place. He saved us from that stuff. He saved us from these Victorian novels about the landed gentry and the wealthy people. And he wrote about child labor and he wrote about stuff going on in the street. He started wielding the novel like an instrument for social change. And that's where Norris came in too, like I talked about earlier, and Twain and Steinbeck and all the writers I really love. They're all writers that have a big heart and a big social conscience that write about regular people. Whereas, you know, you've got Shakespeare's more concerned with big people exercising their dominion. And I feel like Dickens and that line of author DNA is more concerned with, little people being operated on by the larger world.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Jonathan Evason, author of Lawn Boy. The novel is a coming-of-age story about a young man's blue-collar pursuit of the American dream. Whether it's reading your novels, listening or watching you interviewed, or reading some quote from you that a reviewer puts into one of the reviews on your books, you're very well versed with the literary world. I mean, you just didn't start writing without spending a lot of time talking about these folks. You mentioned Hemingway a lot. Where did this come in your life? I mean, you're not an MFA guy.
Mike, I was just an autodidact. You know what I mean? I had to stay at the library because my mom was at work. You know, so librarians turned me on to stuff. I started reading like Vonnegut when I was like 9 or 10 years old, man. I read Breakfast of Champions and I kind of just stumbled my way into stuff and learned about authors from different authors and talked to librarians. And to be honest with you, Bob, I had no facility to talk about this stuff until about 12 years ago when they started publishing my books and I started meeting other writers and readers. And I mean, I was writing in a vacuum. I existed in a vacuum. My friends weren't real big readers. Most of my friends were jocks growing up. Most of my friends before I was published, even in my 30s and stuff, they're smart people, but most of them hadn't read a book since Gunter Grass in college or something. So I just kind of found it on my own. I was the same way with sort of music too. You know, you discover a band and you find out that band was influenced by this band and you go back, but I had no facility to talk about it until I had anybody to talk about it with. So if you asked me what I was doing, like the first round of interviews I ever did was like All About Lulu and like, tell me about why you did it. I mean, I really didn't even have an answer. I don't know. I was just doing it. I was writing stories. I was intuitive. I mean, I think I had a good, not to say that I didn't have a handle on the craft and I knew what I was doing, but I never talked about it with anybody. You know, I couldn't talk about magical realism or what authorial reticence was, or, you know, I didn't even know what the hell's a prismatic lens, or, you know, I didn't know any of the talk. I didn't really even know how to explain it. It was just something I did. I told stories because I was compelled to tell them because it's something I've done since third grade, you know.
Mrs. Hanford had a lot to do with your career, didn't she?
She absolutely did. God rest her soul. I really think my third grade teacher saved my life.
Yeah.
My sister had died in a freak accident the weekend of her 16th birthday. My parents' marriage dissolved after 25 years. My dad moved us up here and left us. I was just kind of at an at-risk place as a kid, you know. 8 years old by the time all this stuff had sort of culminated. And I was really struggling in the classroom. Mrs. Hanford saw that I had an interest in writing. I had just started writing in third grade. just as an outlet. So if you just let me all year long just sit in a corner and write, I'd already had the curriculum because I had taken, I had skipped second grade and gone straight to third grade in California. But then when we moved me here, I was already the youngest kid in the class because it was a September birthday. Then I was 2 years younger. So my mom didn't want me to have social problems. So she just had me do third grade again. And I think that created part of the problem. So, I mean, I'm in a classroom learning stuff I already learned. But then there was all those outside pressures on me, you know, the family stuff. And Mrs. Hamford just nurtured this, she nurtured this interest I had in writing. And, you know, by fourth grade, I published my first children's story, thanks to her. But, of course, that was the last thing I published for, like, 30 years. But it was an auspicious beginning, and then it was just, like, 7 failed novels, at least 500-600 rejection notices. You know, I was that guy that would wallpaper his bathroom with him and things like that. Finally, I just burned them all, and it's cathartic. And actually, I started, you know, placing some of those same stories.
So the other day, I heard Richard Russo speak.
Love as, Russo, man.
Yeah, he's a great guy. And he was talking about the writing life and how it's changed. And he really nailed it. He talked about how it's endangered by ebook pricing, the relentless erosion of copyright protection, scorched earth capitalism of companies like Google and Amazon, spineless publishers who won't stand up to the information wants to be free crowd, as he calls it, internet search engines.
Well, let's not forget the consumers. I mean, you know, I got people, I have my own cousins and stuff like that. They're like, yeah, dude, I'm 15th on the waiting list at the library to get your book. People, they think they're doing you a favor. I mean, I appreciate it. I'm glad you're reading my work. But they're like, hey, look, dude, I found it at the library book sale, $1.99. They get an email about it. And they're like, geez, thanks. Yeah. Trying to make a living here. Yeah, it's cold out there, man. I figure that for every book I actually sell at a retail price, I'm thinking like 15 people are actually consuming the book, you know, whether they just pass it. Or I've gone to book clubs where it's like they just passed one copy of the damn book around or something, you know.
Yeah.
It's tough. And, you know, so I watched all my friends, you know, a lot of my friends just ended up being rock stars because I was in punk bands in my teens and stuff. And a lot of my friends, you know, went on to Pearl Jam and Mudhoney and Soundgarden and Nirvana. And I saw when Napster came along how they had to deal with that. They had to start monetizing it by, like, touring more. But, see, I can't really do that. I do some speaking engagements, but it's kind of hard to go touring and get paid when, you know, all you got to do is look at my schedule and see that I do 50, you know, 50 independent bookstores a year for free. So why should somebody pay for it? It's difficult. Rick Russo is one of the lucky ones, and I'm one of the lucky ones. It's actually managed to, I think, just cultivate a strong enough core audience. It's those people that buy your book like 3 times that keep me going, I think. You know, the people that are really, really just love your stuff, and then they buy it and they give it to somebody and they replace their own copy. Because I know, I mean, I talked to my editor who's been in the business for 50 years. He's just like, oh, yeah, in the 90s, we were still routinely, you know, shipping hundreds of thousands of copies of our mid-list titles. And now, you know, your front titles, like 40,000, 50,000
yeah,
print runs. So it's, yeah.
Well, the good news is that independent bookstores seem to be doing well these days.
They are. It's interesting. You talk to them. They're still very dependent on Barnes & Noble, you know, who used to be the bad guy, you know. But once Border went down, it's an interesting paradigm now because the independent bookstores are doing great, but they really actually still need Barnes & Noble to survive and do well.
Why?
Because Barnes & Noble is so committed to print, and they have such a huge inventory.
Huh.
You know, if they go under, then fiction is going to become more specialized. You know, you're going to see fewer titles. And, you know, it's interesting because it's kind of counterintuitive. But when I talk to the booksellers about it, they explain to me that since Barnes & Noble is so big and so committed to print, that it really affects the publishing paradigm in terms of the variety of titles available to us. Amazon makes even Barnes & Noble look bad.
Yeah,
so.
No kidding. We've run out of time, but I really appreciate the opportunity to, first of all, read your book, and I look forward to the next one. And thanks for joining us today. We do on this show any number of books in nonfiction that have tried to figure out the 2016 election. Everybody's trying to figure out who the base is. Why do the base feel like they do? And we've had a couple of people, 2 or 3 people on Reader's Corner that have tried to figure that out from the nonfiction side of things. I think your novel is a great piece of fiction that is real, that helps people understand who folks are living on the margin and why they were forgotten over recent years and why we need to do something about that. And you bring them to life in a way.
Beautiful. That's music to my ears. I appreciate it. I mean, to hear one person say that about the novel, I mean, that's kind of the whole, that was the goal for the novel.
So. That's exactly what you've done. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Oh, thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me, man.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.